You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Radio MMT respectfully acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land from which we are broadcasting, the Wurundjeri people, and we are broadcasting to the Kulin nations. Our focus is economics, that is, how stuff is produced and distributed. We recognise that for many tens of thousands of years, First Nations people's connection to country successfully embodied the world's oldest continuous economy, which was catastrophically disrupted by genocide and displacement. We acknowledge that we have much to learn to reshape our current extractive and exploitive system to achieve sustainable prosperity for everyone.
Radio MMT. Economics for the rest of us with Anne
and Kev.
Radio MMT.
Looking at the world through the lens of modern monetary theory.
Radio MMT. Macroeconomics for a well-being economy.
Macroeconomics? Like, isn't that incredibly boring?
No, Kevin, it's incredibly interesting. It's all about who gets what and why.
Who gets what and why? Okay, I'm in.
Radio MMT at gmail.com.
Incredibly interesting macroeconomics for the rest of us.
Oh.
Welcome to Radio MMT with Katie and Kev today. Anne's still taking a summer break, and we've got Katie filling in. Very happy and very honoured to have Katie filling in. How are you, Katie?
I'm magnificent. Kev, why have you brought me here today?
Well, it's normally Anne and myself, and I find doing a radio show by myself really difficult because you just, like, it's nice to have a conversation, and I'm not, as it turns out, I'm not a very good conversationalist with myself. I've got a back announce. That was Confidence Man with Holiday, and the reason I played Confidence Man was because that's who I went and saw on New Year's Eve at the bowl. I went to, did you hear about New Year's Eve at the bowl? Confidence Man, Carl Cox, Underworld. It was pretty mega. And do you know Underworld at all?
Is it the same Underworld from the 1980s?
The 1990s. Born Slippy, they had this song, which is on Trainspotting.
I do know them, but I can't say I've kept up with them.
Oh, well, they have a lot of stuff. And they're too, like, I'm 63. These guys are older than me. I think they're about 65, 66. It was a hard rave. They went hard. I'm there trying to keep up with them. They scared me. Anyway, but Confidence Man played before them, and they were with their song Holiday, and we should all be on holidays or coming back from holidays this time of the year. Hey, what are we going to talk about this week, Cuddy? What do you think we should get stuck into?
Well, a little birdie told me that it might be a good idea to talk about money and explain what it is and where it comes from.
Hey, there you go. Hey, I think the plan is with Radio MMT over the forthcoming shows is to go back to MMT 101, explain what MMT is, modern monetary theory. This show's Radio MMT, and we need to analyse the economy because there's a lot of misinformation going on, and it starts with money. As far as I can see, if you don't understand money, how can you understand a monetary system? And yet there is a lot of misinformation, a lot of myths about money, which we hope to address. So this show is kind of like a way to ease back into the year and soften the ground for some forthcoming shows. I'm hoping to have somebody who's far more knowledgeable than you or I joining us for the next show. Maybe Bill Mitchell. We'll see how we go. He's maybe appearing on the next show, and we'll get stuck into things properly. But our job is to soften the ground for the listeners so that their minds are ready to receive enormous amounts of information from a brainiac who has been doing this stuff for decades and decades. So we need to talk about money. The thing about money is that people, even the economics courses that are taught around the world, don't really explain money. They just presume money exists. What's going on with the orthodox understanding of money?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a problem. There are as many definitions of money as there are people in the world, I think. It all comes down to basically the definition of pornography, which is I know it when I see it.
Right.
but the problem is that the textbooks, they don't actually say what money is. They say what money does, that it's a token of exchange, that it's a unit of account.
That's a very – I've never heard it explained that way. It's actually true. They say what money does from their perspective, but they don't really go into what it is, where it comes from, who creates it. They just sort of explain it as something which happens to – create a balance between transactions would be the orthodoxy, yeah?
Yeah, well, I mean, they see it as some sort of natural resource like any other. It comes from somewhere. It's not academically interesting where it comes from. We just know that like any other resource, it's in scarce supply. The market just naturally balances supply and demand for money, and everything just proceeds. If we just use money as an intermediary commodity to facilitate transactions,
to create equilibrium, so that all transactions are fair.
Yeah, and everything works out in at the end. Everyone gets what they want. Everybody gets what they deserve.
How's that going?
Not so well.
Yes. My understanding is that even in the way economics is taught in universities, etc., is that the actual understanding of the origins of money is barely touched. It is basically just described. And like you say, they say that it's something which just exists like gold or silver. You take gold out of the ground and then it's used, or silver out of the ground, or bronze and or seashells, and you just do these transactions and everything balances, and these units of account are kind of used to signify something. They never really go into where that stuff come from, like, and how did that happen? And what I always find interesting, I remember this from quite some time ago. My sister got into 50-cent coins, the round ones, they ceased to be 50 cents because the silver content of the round 50-cent coin exceeded 50 cents. And so then they started becoming a precious metal. And it's an interesting concept, isn't it? Because you've got this token, which everybody thinks has intrinsic value. But as soon as the intrinsic value of the token that you use exceeds its nominal value, is that the right word, nominal?
Then it
ceases to function as a token. Which kind of tells you something about it. You never want your unit of account to actually be worth more than its face value, which means that it is just, it's a representation which comes from somewhere.
I mean, one of the stories that's told is that we transitioned from gold and other precious metals as our money stuff by having these people called goldsmiths who would store gold in vaults for us and give us receipts. So when we needed gold, we'd go to the goldsmith, hand them a receipt, and then they'd give us the gold.
Right.
And then some bright spark worked out, hey, I don't need to move the gold anywhere. If I want to pay for something, I can just use the receipt, just transfer the receipt to somebody else.
Right.
And then they own the gold. And nobody had to go and mess with gold.
Yep.
But the problem is that once you start doing that, you start thinking, well, what do you need the gold for in the first place?
And the other thing is, and this is the thing which always happens, is how much is the gold worth? Because you might have a receipt for the gold, but then gold is only worth what it's worth when you transfer it to a currency. And so gold in itself isn't a currency. Gold is a commodity. So you can back your currency with gold, as has happened in the past. Turns out to be not such a good idea. And that idea has been used on occasion. But I think I'm referring back to Graeber's 5,000 years of debt. And the whole thing of having a gold-backed currency is not normal. It's a thing which happens occasionally.
Yeah, it's more the exception than the rule, because it does go catastrophically wrong. And as soon as it does go catastrophically wrong, you find out that all the people who believed in the sanctity of gold as the ultimate store of value suddenly don't believe in it anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, the same thing happens with other crazy ideas that, like, small government advocates try to use to restrict the power of the public by saying, well, we should have a debt ceiling. We should start worrying about the debt. We should have a legislated debt ceiling, or we should have a constitutional amendment to require balanced budgets. Things like that that prevent the government from spending as much money as is needed to spend on the idea that government is an inherently untrustworthy actor in the economy.
Yeah, well, and sometimes they can be. There's some sort of basis to that. And I think that one of the reasons that the mythology around the finite supply of money in terms of government, there's always this thing about a government can't spend more than it receives in tax revenue is the common misbelief, or that it has to have enough gold stored to issue its currency against in the gold standard days. And I just sort of sometimes wonder, like, you could transfer that to anything. Like, Commodores are pretty handy now. So rather than having gold, you could have a Commodore-backed currency where the government has a scrapyard full of old Commodores.
Right? This would be the car or the old computers?
The car.
Right.
The car, and not the band either. So there's a thought. You could have... And that would be a very Australian dollar, wouldn't it? You could have a government with this big car yard full of old, like, thousands of old Commodores, and it can create as many dollars as there are Commodores available, and the price of those Commodores might go up or down. You know, that's the same with gold. It's exactly the same thing. That's what confuses people. Is people just think, well, gold has some inherent value? Well, no, it doesn't. It's just this shiny metal. It's worth different
different things at different times, but it's worth what it's worth when it's transferred to a currency. And that currency didn't just pop out of thin air. It wasn't just something that just magically happened. The currency is an orchestrated thing. And this is the mythology that surrounds the orthodoxy at the moment. One of the things I don't understand is the orthodoxy, they won't say that money comes from the government. They say that money comes from the markets. If they believe that, where do they think it comes from?
Yeah, this is Stephanie Kelton's idea that people believe that money grows on rich people.
Yeah.
And everything that we have comes as crumbs brushed from the rich people's table. Therefore, we need to have a stock of billionaires as the sort of modern day replacement for gold. We have a billionaire backed currency now, apparently.
So we need rich people for the economy to survive, and that is very much the current ideology, that we need rich people to run a successful economy, because if we don't have rich people, then there's not going to be enough taxes paid to fund government spending. And we won't have enough money in the economy to pay people. If we need to have employment, we need to have rich people doing industrious things, or not even industrious things, just doing anything to employ people, to engage people. And that's the current perception. The only problem with that perception is that where did the rich people get their money from? Because if they made it themselves, they go to jail, right?
True.
And this is the fundamental flaw with the orthodoxy, is that they don't seem to be able to explain the difference between who actually creates the money and who uses the money. Now, rich people use money, but they don't create money. The money is can only be created by government. That's the law. That's the same in most economies, but we'll just talk about the Australian economy. Anybody else tries to create Australian dollars in Australia, and it's not authorised by the RBA. Like, if you had some rich person out there saying, "Oh, righty, I'm going to actually go and create a whole bunch of Australian dollars," you go to jail. That's against the law. So, I mean, it should be fairly obvious that if the government makes the money and then rich people accumulate the money, do we actually need rich people to run the economy?
No. Rich people need us to supply the money that makes them rich. And the government has spent 50 years very assiduously creating billionaires. I don't know why. Nobody ever asked for billionaires, but they think this is somehow very important. And if we let our stock of billionaires go too low, we'll all kick up a stink. But frankly, I can do without them altogether.
Yeah, I reckon I could do without them. I've seen a couple of them recently. They've been getting very involved in American politics, and I wasn't overly impressed. So billionaires, they need us to A, create the things that they make their money from a lot of the time. Well, that's more industrial capitalization. That's more back in the industrial days. These days, there's a whole bunch of financial capitalism, and they don't need us for that at all. But let's stick with the industrial model. So let's say you've got somebody who's going to get rich by actually making something. They need people to work for them, and then they need those same people that are working for them quite often to buy the things that they're making to make them rich. And then we're getting into Marxism now, because now we're talking about, what's the term they use?
The labour theory of value.
The labour theory of value, where you have to exploit your worker. You need your worker to create more value than you pay them for them to, and that equals profit. So
this is another idea that says that money comes from anywhere except from government. In this case, money comes from the surplus value of labour.
So what we're talking about here is when billionaires accumulate money, it's not because they make money, it's because they use money and then they're able to accumulate money. They're able to acquire more and more money and hang on to it. And that's usually done, or quite often it's done, through exploiting workers. Is there any profit which is done without exploitation, or is it? Would you say that profit is more exploitative in some cases than others, and that if you share some of the proceeds of your profit, it's not seen to be as bad as if you're just a slave owner, for instance?
Yeah. I mean, basically, firms will do whatever they can get away with, and in recent years they've been able to get away with quite a lot.
Yeah.
And it's all about how much can I exploit customers, suppliers, and workers. They will do what they can get away with. Supermarkets are a magnificent example of that.
Yeah.
But it's a question of, well, when is the government going to step in and do something about that? Because the government permits it by saying that the thing that's supposed to discipline firms is the market. It's consumer sovereignty. But when the market consists of one or two firms that are huge necessarily by the fact that, you know, they have these sort of incredible economies of scale that make it possible to deliver things very cheaply.
And we're seeing this in real time. We're seeing what was supposed to be market-driven competition become more and more monopolised as one firm buys its competitors and just becomes bigger and bigger. And all this is allowed to occur because of this misconception that rich people make money, when in fact rich people don't make money. Rich people use money, which is literally made by the government. They get away with it because this fanciful story is so widely accepted that activity and wealth creates money, when in fact activity and wealth accumulates money, and it accumulates the money that is made by the government. And we know that the money is made by the government because, like we said before, you go to jail if you try and make your own. But it also says, take out any note, and we says it 1,000 times, it says, you know, authorised by the Governor of the Reserve Bank and authorised by Treasury. It's clearly an instrument of government. That's the notes and coins, of which there's only a small amount, but everything else is spent into existence. We call it, it's spent into existence by the government. So whenever the government needs to pay for something, it creates money and then buys what it needs or spends that into the economy, and that money then becomes part of the economy. That's where money comes from. That's not a secret. Everybody knows that. They do it all the time. They do it with the military. They did it during COVID. They did it during World War II. They did it during the GFC. There's so many examples that we see every year. Every budget is an example of how the government creates a certain amount of money. That's what they spend, and that money then enters the economy. That's how it works. I struggle with trying to figure out where the disconnect lies.
Yeah, and I think you made a very good point making the distinction between industrial capitalism and financial capitalism, which has been key to the story of the last 30 years or so, which is what drives industrial capitalism, or productive investment, is sales. But if the majority of the population is really hard up and there's a handful of billionaires, you're not going to get the sales that drives the productive investment in creating things that people actually want. What you'll get is a whole lot of money that the government's pumped, well, not pumped, that's a very bad term, spent into the economy.
Yeah.
Which goes towards encouraging savings, which goes towards cutting the rate of tax on investment in housing and subsidising superannuation, all sorts of these financial sort of exploits, instead of going into producing the goods and services that people actually need.
I think we need to talk about this more, Katie. You're with Kevin Cady on Radio MMT. We're discussing what money is. We've talked about how the orthodoxy explains money. It's not a very good explanation, so I think we need to throw to a song, have a bit of a think about this, and come back and maybe talk about how things should be done. Katie, we're going to throw to a song by The Fall called Touch Sensitive.
pulls up. I say, give me a taxi. Don't say it's very cold. You are drunk or too old. Taxi, hey, Cecil. Hey. If the cows are on the street, if you smile, you are a creep.
I know.
It's just saying, Cecil.
Hey, hey, hey.
If you don't say it's very cold.
Hey,
you're with Anne and Kev on Radio MMT.
At 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia.
And wherever you get your podcasts.
Economics for the rest of us.
Disasters like flood, fire and extreme heat can have a significant impact on people's lives. Community legal centres help people experiencing challenges posed by climate change and disasters to access the resources and support they need. Disasters can lead to a range of problems, such as damage to your home, poor conditions with your rental home, difficulty getting insurance, issues within families, at work and with Centrelink payments. Community legal centres can be found across Victoria and can provide help if you've been affected by a disaster. To find a community legal centre near you, visit the Federation of Community Legal Centres website at fclc.org.au. You can also contact Disaster Legal Help Victoria on 1800 113 432 and go to its website for helpful information at disasterlegalhelp.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
You're on Radio MMT with Katie and Kev. That last one is particularly pertinent. That last community announcement is a bit particularly pertinent today. It's stinking hot out there. It's one of those days. I don't know how it's going to go out there. There's fires around the place, etc. This is all a part of how our environment's changing, you know, due to capitalists exploiting everything and not paying attention to anything. I hope that it's not as bad as the last time the weather was like this, which was it was a while ago. I was down in Aspendale today at the beach, as I was the last time we had really bad bushfires, and it's a very similar day, just this screaming northerly coming through and things are on fire, and you didn't really find out until afterwards, you know. So, but there's a bit of a cool change coming through now, Katie. I hope it's settling in. I hope it's bringing some relief. I hope it's not making things worse because the wind changes and then the fire heads off in a different direction. So we'll see how they go.
But fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed, you know, yeah. Anyway, look, we've been speaking about money, we spent the first half of the show explaining the confused mythology that the orthodoxy has when it comes to understanding money, how they believe it's this thing which comes from somewhere never quite explained properly that is used by private markets to balance transactions. That's how the orthodoxy kind of understands money. They use gold and silver a lot, and they seem to ignore the fact that money is created by governments. Katie, it's not complicated. It's very obvious that governments create money. Why do governments create money?
In order to provide the goods and services that are required to fulfil the what we in MMT land call the public purposes.
So it's a public utility money. It's there. It's created by government, by elected representatives. In the case of Australia, they have the ability to create money on demand. The government decides what its priorities are. It then instructs its treasury to instruct the RBA to pay people to fulfil the functions of government. Now, I don't know, this is this kind of thing that government's evil. Government is supposed to be a democratic representation of the population. If government's evil, it's because we've let it get evil, let it become evil. But in a properly functioning democracy, government would be creating money and applying it to the priorities of its population. What's happened?
Yeah, well, I think essentially we have a class of economists who function as courtiers to the rich, and their advice is to basically say, as we were describing earlier, that money is just a commodity like any other, and the government therefore should not or ought not create more of it under its own, you know, steam. It's the job of government to manage its money, rather than the job of government to use its money to manage the economy, which is what was done from World War II onwards, when quite a few people realised, hey, if we could spend whatever's necessary to defeat fascism, and employ everybody in the population in the process, well, why can't we have full employment in peacetime? Employ everybody, educate everybody, ensure that there's healthcare for everybody.
I think it's kind of important to realise that the post-World War II period in the worldwide economy was a strange time in history where there was some sort of understanding that the government's role was to utilise resources, and there seemed to be something of a willingness to create stability and peace after World War II, so long as you were white and middle class and not too far on the fringes. But that was better than nothing, I guess. So there was an understanding then that government could use its fiscal capacity to mobilise resources for the public good, because that's what it had to do during World War II. It had to mobilise resources to defeat fascism, as you said. Interesting now that the country that took the main credit for destroying fascism has now become somewhat fascist itself. Interesting turn of events.
Yes.
Nonetheless, and you can see what happens when you allow one country to dominate too much without any checks and balances, and they end up electing somebody like Donald Trump. You end up with innocent people getting shot for stopping, stormtroopers from kidnapping their neighbours. I digress. But the point was that after World War II, there was an understanding that government could use its fiscal capacity, its spending capacity, its ability to create currency and apply it to resources to create a stable and better world. We seem to have gone off track there somewhere, but and that's government willingly allowing and permitting itself to hand over the reins of control, because essentially money which is created by government can be used quite effectively to control the economy and therefore control the distribution of wealth, the distribution of resources, so that you have a much fairer and better society. But they've gone off track.
Yeah. The story that was sold to us was that as a point of logic, that the private sector is always more efficient than government, which if you've ever actually worked in the private sector, you know is not necessarily the case. An important question to ask is efficient for whom? Firms are getting very, very efficient at squeezing their workers, their customers and their suppliers, which for them is efficiency. But in the case of
the public well-being, the public good, it's not so efficient.
So, I mean, efficiency for a firm with market power, like, say, a supermarket who's able to squeeze their suppliers, can mean that agricultural producers are making so little money that they're unable to make any investments in their own enterprises, which means that their enterprises, the equipment that they use to carry out their business, doesn't get maintained, doesn't get improved. They're not necessarily going to go out of business tomorrow, but the thing is they're being made less efficient than they could be because they're making less of the income than they could be.
Yeah, and I've just realised recently, we talk about how modern wonders have allowed us to eat well. We can eat things out of season, and we have this variety of things that we wouldn't normally be able to eat. But then I've also learned that everything has been reduced down to 5 grains, that human beings used to have a much wider variety of things to eat. But because agriculture has become, like you say, a family-owned farm will struggle. Eventually, they'll get taken over by a large conglomerate. That large conglomerate will do a lot of monoculture, and they'll reduce their crops to these 5 grains to streamline stuff, because it's good in the free trade between countries, etc., to have everything the same. But we miss out in the end. This is what happens when we let corporate interests and large firms start dictating policy by politicians who we elect in to represent us.
Yeah.
And we see that this whole the whole monetary system is then hijacked for the interests of the people that pay for the election campaigns of the parties who are competing to become government, as opposed to money being used in the public good. It's not good.
Yeah, and efficiency in a narrow sense can defeat efficiency in a broad sense. This is something called Javan's paradox, which was identified in the late 19th century. If an industry becomes so efficient that it produces much more for their investment,
right,
then if the price goes down, that doesn't necessarily mean everybody has an easier life because they have to spend so much less. What it actually can be is a spur to simply use more of whatever that is.
Yeah.
So efficiency of production is not necessarily the thing we should be concentrating on, especially when, as you say, we have a climate crisis sort of heading towards us at great speed. Efficiency of consumption is something that we ought to consider, and that's something that can be provided by having the government provide goods on a collective basis rather than the government withdrawing services and saying, no, you've got to go and get it for yourself. So if you want to get from A to B, you have to have your own car. You can't rely on public transport. If you want to
do anything, you've got to be self-sufficient.
Yeah.
I always think, like, you know, you go down any suburban street, if there's 20 houses in that street, there'll be 20 lawnmowers. They're not all operating at the same time. The whole idea of collectivism is far more efficient in terms of the population, but it doesn't suit the efficiency of profit, because profit would prefer there to be 20 lawnmowers in a street rather than 3 or 4 that were shared, so that they can make their money. And I guess the point is that if government does create money, government therefore should have the ultimate control, should be able to use money as a fairly heavy-handed lever of controlling its population and the distribution of wealth if it wanted to. Sometimes that's called socialism. Sometimes that works well, and sometimes when you introduce too much change and you're met with resistance, it becomes violent, especially when you've got the world's largest capitalist country willing to invade any communist country it sees fit to put socialism, to crush socialism. You're going to end up with a lot of violence. I digress. But you can see that when a government understands it has the currency issuing capacity, it then chooses how it's going to use that currency issuing capacity to distribute wealth in its community. And we've seen that hijacked by corporate interests, by profit, at the expense of normal populations. We need to sort of get more socialist, I think, Katie.
Well, and I mean, it's not an either-or choice between two extremes. A great way of disciplining the market is by providing what in the US they call a public option. So about 3 weeks ago, John Stewart had Lina Khan, the former Federal Trade Commission boss under Biden, on his podcast. And they were talking about Zoran Mamdani and his idea of rolling out publicly owned supermarkets across New York City. And literally John Stewart said, well, it's like for anything that's a basic necessity for a decent human life, there ought to be a public option. And that public option would discipline the market and stop the one or two major firms in that market from abusing people.
You can hear the capitalists screaming out already that the government would have an unfair advantage using its fiscal capacity to make the market unsustainable. When in fact, what they're really saying is they don't want to have to compete against.
They don't want to compete. They don't want to, like, they innovate on how well they can basically abuse people.
Yeah.
They don't want to innovate on providing actual better quality goods and services.
Yeah.
That's the last thing they want. They certainly don't want to compete on price.
No.
As the mainstream economists say that they inevitably do. They don't.
Yeah. This the whole idea of more social engagement. It is so encouraging to see socialist mayors being elected in the states. I am concerned about that because I've seen what the US does when socialists pop up. They don't like it, and they'll start a smear campaign. They'll start saying, you know, he's corrupt, he's this, he's that, anything they can and put their hands on. Exactly what they've done in Venezuela. They start blowing up boats, saying that this is all drug money, and that's how the economy works there. Demonize the person in charge, and they say we need to intervene. They've done it in numerous places through South America. I wonder how they're going to handle their socialist mayors in their own country.
I think Mamdani was very clever, and he didn't do what, he's hardly a socialist, more a sort of soft progressive, really.
Right.
But he didn't do what the Democrats in America and the Labour Party in Australia and the UK generally do, which is they preempt the criticism, they preempt the name calling and the accusations by veering off to the right. And being less progressive.
Yeah.
He actually said, well, they're going to call me names anyway. I might as well just double down and say, yes, that's who I am.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm an immigrant, Muslim. Yeah. And a socialist. Although you say he's not. I don't know what his socialist credentials are. We're talking about socialists a lot. Speaking about the socialists, I tapped into the Jacobin Society just recently and bought their ABC of socialism. And this goes back to the point before we were talking about where there's this perception that we need capitalism to run a proper economy. And I saw this repeated even in their literature, where they were saying that it's this perception that governments are reliant on tax revenue for their spending. Now, we've already explained that that's not the case, that the governments create money themselves, just depending on their ideology and their political preferences. If they think that submarines need to be built, they create the money to pay for the submarines to be built. If they think that we need a good social welfare system, they will invest in the social welfare of their country. These aren't tax-dependent decisions, and we've seen this exemplified through COVID, through the GFC, through World War II, through numerous occasions. I've just been reading about Whitlam. Whitlam was fantastic. I love Whitlam. Oh, so good. And you can see what a government can achieve when it wants to. If the socialists believe that they are reliant on tax revenue to run their government, they're shooting themselves in the foot. I don't want to start a fight. We're all on the same side. I'm not here to argue. I'm just here to say either I've got it wrong or the socialists have got it wrong, and the socialists got it wrong. Well, in this book they have anyway. If socialism could understand the monetary system better and understood that government creates money, then the idea of having a society that has far more government involvement would be far easier to attain.
Yeah, and you could achieve that piecewise. I mean, one step at a time. André Gors had this magnificent term, non-reformist reforms. Like, if you understand that progressing to a better stage of civilization doesn't require burning everything down to the ground and starting from scratch, you can do it one step at a time and just say, well, okay, where do we want to go? How do we get there from here? What are the next steps? How do we get people on board? Not for the grand utopian vision at the end of all of that, but just for the next steps. Go one step at a time and gather more and more people on board as they see it working. Then that becomes a credible path to, solving our long-term problems.
And this is a reversal of the neoliberal strategy, because that's what they've done. One step at a time, they've taken us further and further to this private market ideology. And we find ourselves in 40, 50 years since 1975, since poor old Gough lost his prime ministership in very dubious circumstances. We've seen the neoliberals, in fact, it started before then. Hayden was infected by neoliberalism, and it was already creeping in. It wasn't done quickly. There was no neoliberal revolution.
Nobody was saying, please take away our old age pensions and public housing.
It just happened little bit by little bit. So the problem we've got with that strategy is that we've got a few time constraints which are might need it to happen a little quicker than the time frame that the neoliberals have used. And one of them is the environment, which, as we can tell today, is struggling a bit. And so there's a bit more speed needed. And in fact, maybe some of these things like climate change and some of the effects that are going to become very obvious to people might help accelerate the change back to a more socially inclusive, socially aware, considerate government, and they might be able to use their fiscal capacity to start addressing things, because they're going to have to, because if things start burning down or we've got floods up in Queensland at the same time as we've got Victoria on fire, these require government assistance. These it might help accelerate the attitude in the community to accept a more government-involved economy, and one which is not so reliant on private enterprise, which is the cause of the problem.
Yeah, I mean, if you make sure everyone's employed and housed and clothed and fed, then you're halfway there. You know, we don't need to dig up rocks and methane gas and ship it overseas for somebody else to use in order to get Australian dollars. We have an unending supply of Australian dollars, which means we can employ everyone, we can house everyone, we can educate everyone. And that's the start. That is a significant improvement over what we've got.
So we're going for a soft revolution, not a hard, violent revolution, a soft revolution, but it needs to happen a little quicker than it's happening at the moment. I'd suggest the Albanese government could be a little more proactive in their current circumstances. They're in their second term. They've got at least two more terms. We're talking about four terms in government. You can achieve a lot in four terms, but I have a feeling that they might be taking a leaf out of the Menzies government, who were around for a very long time and did very little. People talk about the Menzies government as if it was this golden era of politics. You look at the achievements under the Menzies government, nothing. It's just sitting there. Nothing particularly fantastic happened. It was small policy all the way, and that seems to be the model that the Albanese government, which is basing itself on. I think Howard did the same. The biggest thing he did was the GST, I think.
The biggest thing he did was halving the capital gains on on housing.
There's a whole litany of things that he did that advanced the causes of neoliberal, but they were just snuck in. There was the GST was the only thing that stood out as something that was fairly radical. Everything else was, that's a good idea. And he's in there for four terms and he's just slipping in these things and things. So over time, over the 10, 12 years that he was in, there was a fairly dramatic shift in the way that we operated, but it was done by stealth. If the Albanese government wants to make a mark on the Australian society, I think it should have a look at people like Gough Whitlam, who in 3 years and through a headwind and just constant badgering and undermining and people lining him up to take it sideways, in 3 years he changed the way we operate enormously, because he wasn't concerned about the fiscal capacity of the government, it seemed, at the time. He just brought in free education. Done, you know, free university education, smack it through. Medibank, it was called there, Medicare, which, what have we got now, Medicare?
It was Medibank that Whitlam introduced. Medicare was Hawke and Keating.
Yeah, Fraser took it out and then Hawke and Keating brought in the other one. That was all laid down by Whitlam. So and they were told at the time, this is terrible, we're going to go broke. Nothing happened like that. Australia ended up a much better place because of big, bold decisions. You've just got to sell it, and that's the problem, I guess, that the Albanese government is facing, is they don't know how to sell it.
Yeah, well, I mean, before you can sell it, you need to have some sort of grassroots constituency, which basically is why we have a fantastic educational radio program like
us.
This.
We're here. We can change it. They should speak to us. The Albanese government should speak to us. We will sell it to them, because people listen to us, don't they, Katie?
Of course.
dear me. Well, we love our listeners because they do get this. They understand it. I often try and figure out what's the point of a show like this. We don't have a large listenership. We're this little flicker, this little kind of ember that just keeps glowing. The point is, an ember, and it's not a good analogy to use on a day like today, but an ember can start a fire, but the ember has to be there. And that's what we do on this show, is we just keep the ember glowing so that when it's ready to take off, it takes off. And I do understand the context of today's weather by that. But that's the analogy, is that you, I, and our listeners and this community, we are here to keep these ideas alive so that when change can occur, it starts from somewhere. That's us.
Exactly.
Is that where we finish the show today, Katie?
I think that's a good note, positive note to end on.
Look, it's been lovely having you on the show again today, Katie. We're going to wrap up now because Mafalda's coming up next. The next show, which is the last show in January, I'm hoping to have Bill Mitchell on to further this conversation as we go back to the roots of MMT and start the understanding of MMT from the beginning, because it's important to go over it to reinforce what we already know.
From one of the founders, no less.
From one of the founders, from the guru of MMT, Bill Mitchell himself. Haven't got that interview yet, so cross your fingers. But till then, see you later.
You've been listening to Radio MMT with Anne and Kev.
We'd love your feedback. Email us on radiommt@gmail.com or search Radio MMT on social media.
Listen to this show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or on 3cr.org.au/Radio MMT.
Support this show and the station by subscribing to 3cr.org.au and mention Radio MMT.
We thank all our guests.
And we thank economist Professor Bill Mitchell and his MMTED.org, educating the masses on modern monetary theory.
And thank you to our listening listeners for listening. And I thank you, Kevin.
And I thank you, Anne. So what's planned for next week?
Kevin, there is still so much to talk about. We've got to expose all this rotten economics.
Well, yeah, no, that's good, and I get it. Do you reckon we could use a bit more music?
Well, I made a list of all these terrible economic theories. Like, have you heard of the theory of comparative advantage, or the quantity theory of money, or the loanable funds theory?
Have you heard of a band called Single Gun Theory? Like, they're a really good band. I'm sure there's a whole range of, like, macroeconomic music that I could bring into the show.
Yeah, but we really need to do marginal productivity theory, not to mention the natural rate of unemployment and the money multiplier.
You've got a pretty good singing voice. I play bass. Bill, he plays guitar. I reckon we could form a macroeconomics band. Like, we could deliver this whole message.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.